Hello and welcome to the NRG podcast, The Horse That Asked Why, and other stories. So welcome to the latest episode of the NRG podcast, The Horse That Asked Why, and other stories. This is going to be an interesting one. I'm joined by my partners in crime, Ross Ainsley, who's fresh off the plane from a transatlantic flight, and by the looks of things, gone straight from the airport straight to the pub. And then Mr. Gilmore, who I think I might put it on the socials, the voice note that you sent us at 2 o'clock in the morning, Glenn, that probably not. But so there's going to be a lot of questions headed to Mr. Gilmore because he sounds on top form. So quick round the houses. Glenn, tell us all about what you've been up to, mate.
Well, I didn't get much sleep last night.
And why was that, Glenn? Why was that? Tell us all about that.
I was the MC at the shirt presentation for the under-21s, the ladies' test match between Australia and New Zealand, and then the test match international on Sunday between India and Australia. So it was quite cool to be MC of that and present shirts in the Royal Pub, the Royal Hotel in Richmond, which was cool. I was ready to leave at 9:30, and then the dreaded rum and coke came out, and yeah, things just escalated, I'm going to call it.
They went downhill fast.
No, far from downhill. It was amazingly good fun, but I'm not feeling the greatest right now.
And you've also been at Garangula, haven't you, Glenn?
Yeah, I was at Garangula for the week. That was pretty cool.
Tell us a little bit more about that, because I want to put you through as much pain as I possibly can. So tell us all in very, very specific detail about what you got up to at Garangula, Glenn.
Well, I stayed with Mum and Dad, which was cool to see them. And I got to see Lucci and Lockie and all the horses go, and then all of the very good polo at Garangula. I was there for the week, watched the final between White Deer Park and Alistair White. Seriously cool game. And we've been in Sydney, and unfortunately, I think the amount of rain that's going to happen this weekend might end up causing all of the polo to get cancelled, which is super sad for everyone that's put so much effort into making an international run. And when the weather kills it, it's horrible. But feels like that's what's going to happen. You can hear the rain. Oh, you guys can't hear it, but I can hear it behind me.
We can hear it, yeah.
Yeah, and it looks like Lucci's been going well. All that coaching that Lockie's been giving her is paying off.
Mate, Lucci went to zero in New Zealand, and I saw the fruits of her labour and how much work she's been doing in New Zealand, and I am absolutely blown away by how well she played yesterday. Rode the horses beautifully, was going to the boards and turning the ball left and then hitting good passes, and it was really cool. And Ross had told me how well she played over there with him, and Lucci played it down, but it was freaking cool to see her go so well.
No, she played really well.
Testament to the amount of work that she's done in, you know, the coaching that Lockie's been giving her. So I think that's fantastic. So Ross Ainsley, you've had a relatively busy time.
Busy time. Yeah. Singapore yesterday. That was great. It was awesome seeing everyone in Singapore. There's so many like great people there. It's a cool club. It's a cool environment, and certainly wonderful people. Day and a half there, and then flew to Munich for a stopover. Not sure why that was part of my trip, but did that, and then got into London this morning at Heathrow this morning at 8. Came straight out to Lambourne. And to see the boys, Jess picked me up, superstar. She's got everything so well organised. And so they've got 12 in work, 12 or 13? 13 in work out here, which all look really good and going well. And then ripped back and to Kilmwood, about an hour back the other way, and rode with Andrew. We did a bunch of horses and then came back out here again. And a couple of other jobs. And then now we're on here and it's 9:45 p.m. So let's rip into it.
Absolutely.
You're looking very fresh, Roscoe. You look as if you've just popped out of a salon, mate.
No, thanks, mate.
You look so good.
I popped out of bag and everything. Actually, we went to the pub for dinner.
Oh, so it's not just me.
No,
hey?
It was Guinness.
So good. Well, thank you very much for that, gentlemen. So what we're going to do is
Nick May, what's Nick May up to? Is it snowing in Norway, Nick May?
It is snowing again in Norway. We had beginning of the week, we had 10 degrees. We thought that we'd broken the back of it. And then we've had the most sour wind for about the last, when I say we Norway, not me specifically, the most sour wind for, and then temperature dropped again and we've had snow all day. And I just want it to go away. Just go away. So that is, it's been very dull. We're desperate to get going. Trying to get the horses fit, but the weather is just, and I know it's very wet in the UK at the minute, but the weather's just not cooperating at all. But there you go. Right. Which brings us on to our guest for this evening. So Glenn, I know you've done a lot of preparation. So Glenn, you want to talk us through the introduction to our guest for this evening, please?
Okay. I have been lucky enough to know this man for quite a long time. He's been involved with horses for all of his life. I'm actually really interested to know how he started and got into horses. But I've seen him playing horses, breaking horses, and being involved in our sport, and then getting into the racing game with breaking in horses there. And it's I've watched him in action, breaking the horses in, and it's really cool the way he does stuff. So I'm super cool, keen to get to know more about what he does and how he got into it. Yeah.
Marty Lacey, very good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for staying up. And it's good that at least 50% of the people on the call are sober, which is fantastic statistic that we aspire to. So, Marty, as Glenn has alluded to, Horseman, you're spending a lot of time working with the Unbroken Horses. We specifically wanted to speak to you. It's one of the things that we're going to sort of get to with other interviews as well. We wanted to speak to people who've got experience with young horses from completely unbroken, off the track, homebreds, from, you know, that have come from all different walks of life. And we wanted to start with you, Marty, because we know that you do so much work with the, you know, horses that are completely unhandled and unstarted. And Roscoe's going to derail it straight away. Here we go. This is going to be good.
What do they call it in England? Do they still call it breaking in Australia? Like in England, they call it backing.
Yeah, it's still pretty much. Well, in the racing world, it's still called breaking in.
In my world, it's still called breaking in, just because that's just tradition. The name.
Yeah, I think it's here. You know, there's a few people like I did a lot in North America, and it's cult starting there, but here it's still breaking in.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think if you get into a few of the other disciplines, maybe the dressage world and that, they probably don't call it breaking in. But in the racing world, it's still called breaking in.
Sorry, Nick, you were saying?
No, it was a very valid point, Roscoe, and thank you very much for interrupting the flow of where we were going. So much appreciated. So, Marty, if you can talk us through a little bit about your journey into horses and basically how you got to sort of where you are today, please, mate.
Yeah, for sure. Look, I grew up in Queensland, and my parents, like, we had horses all the time. My parents rode horses to school. So the horses were just sort of a part of, as soon as we were kids and big enough, there were always horses around, and we were thrown on and grew up on a sort of a cropping and cattle property, so it was horses not every day, but pretty close to it. So, and I don't know, there was five of us kids, and I'm not sure if Mum and Dad wanted to thin a few out, because some of these horses that they put us on were pretty willing to that. And those were the days where there were no helmets, there was not much sort of concern around safety. It was like, get on, ride.
Which part of Australia?
So grew up near Kingaroy until I was, you know, finished primary school, and then we moved to Monte, which is just south of Rockhampton. Yeah, so we ended up in that sort of area, and then I going through school. I think I was about 12, and my eldest brother and I used to ride track work for a neighbour up the road. We'd jump on our motorbike, and if he couldn't do it, I'd do it. And we'd ride the motorbike about 10 minutes up the road, and we'd go and he'd plowed a track around his farm. So we'd jump on and go and do track work with his racehorses there, do that before school. And that was pretty funny because he was an old school bookie in those days. So once a month he'd pop the boot on his old Falcon and there'd just be lines of cash. And then he'd pay us out of the boot at the farm. It was very funny. And so I'd head home with a pocket full of cash. Yeah, we were riding horses nearly every day, mustering, and then the track were open. Then my brothers and I, we ended up with a couple of decent ponies, and we used to bet around bareback, no bridles, at night time. We'd have dinner and then we'd just disappear and flat out around the paddocks around the house. And so I guess you just learned to ride, and then it sort of went on from there. And then I worked on a few properties when I left school and worked with some really good horsemen there, some guys who were really good camp drafters. So
who were they?
A guy called Wayne Moxon Price from Central Queensland. And he had some very well-bred stock horses, and back to the old heritage lines of Cadets and those sort of Ribbly Ray, those sort of horses. And Wayne just had a lot of really good techniques of, just getting camp draft horses to wait, and had a pretty big property, so we're on horses all day long. So I learned a lot about horses there, and Dad wasn't a horse trainer or a horse breaker or anything, but he was a good rider, so he just taught me the basics of riding. And then while I was working for Wayne, I went to a couple of Ken May horsemanship clinics. And Ken had done a lot of work in the States with Ray Hunt and with the American style. So he was sort of one of the, I think, the original guys that brought the American style of, horse breaking and horsemanship training back to Australia. So I did a couple of his clinics. I did one breaking in and one, working cow horse style clinic. So I learned a lot from Ken about, he taught me how to lay them down and, lay them down properly instead of just the old school pulling them down, and just a lot about pressure relief, just a lot of the actual horsemanship side of things. So I learned a very good base there.
He was a good communicator.
Ken was a great talker, and he was a very good, in his clinics, it was fun. He was fun, and he'd have a big group, but he could get everyone he's very good at, getting the whole group involved and really explaining and talking and showing, he had very good horses and he showed you what he wanted, and it was very clear, and to me it was really easy, and I had a good base, and then I learnt a lot of techniques, and then from there I went and worked in the Northern Territory. And that was an eye-opener because I arrived at the start of the season and there were about 100 horses brought in that not one person knew anything about. And we all got told these are horses they used for the stock camp previous years. And I'm like, righto. And I'd sort of been worded up before I went there saying, don't go there and tell these guys you know how to ride because you get put on the roughest of the rough. And those were the days when Longreach College was still running, and they were doing a horsemanship clinic at Longreach College. So you'd get kids straight out of the city that had never ridden. They'd go to Longreach College for 6 months or something, and then they'd send them to these stations as stockmen or stockwomen. And it was dangerous. So we got these 100-odd horses in, and it was sort of my job to sift out what was rideable and what was not. And I'd tell you, that was then a very interesting experience. There was a lot of horses that I let go in the paddock. So that was pretty rough and tumble, but I actually worked with a guy there called Mick Hayes, who's a very good camp drafter, and the whole Hayes family are in sort of that Mundubbera, Central Queensland area, and Mick's a very good camp drafter. So I learned a lot from Mick, just, you know, we're mustering together all day long. And, yeah, he just, you know, taught me a lot about camp drafting in Cattleworth. Then, yeah, so you're on a horse literally all day long. You'd be on a horse at 4 o'clock in the morning and you'd get off it at maybe 4 or 5 that afternoon, and just massive mobs of cattle. You know, Newcastle is 3.2 million acres. Had like nearly 40,000 head of cattle, so you spend a bit of time on a horse. So once I finished up in the territory, I went to Canada. And I arrived there in winter time, so not much horsework going on. So I spent a little bit of time skiing, and then I ended up meeting a guy at a ranch out near Banff. And I went to work at this ranch, and it was a horse ranch, just helping him with that. And I met a guy called Wayne Powell, who was a professional saddlebrook rider. And so, you know, I'd sort of watched radios and never really been involved in them. And Wayne was like, why don't you come with me to a practice night? So we jumped in the car, middle of winter, and we ended up in an Indian reservation up in the, you know, hills of Alberta near Banff. And they have these massive indoor arenas there where they buck horses and bulls every week on a Wednesday night or something like that. And what they do is they run all these horses in out of the Indian reservation that have never seen man before, and they pick them. And then you're the crash test dummy, and then the horses are like, well, if they, you know, it's a massive business in North America. So then if the horses continue bucking, they end up into the rodeo system. So that was my first intro into rodeo, was at these Indian reservations on these that were, well, like, yeah, massive and pretty out of control. So I got into that for a little bit, and then got into the summer, and then my job was there to break in all the horses on this ranch. So I did a lot of that. And then ended up going back to Canada and rodeoing professionally for a couple of years, and that's all I did was rodeo on weekends. We'd do sort of 6 to 8 rodeos a weekend riding saddlebrocks.
Just saddle, or did you have a go at bareback and bulls?
Yeah, I had one go at bareback and one go at bulls, and that was me done. I stuck with the saddle.
So this is brilliant. So what's the life of a rodeo saddlebronc rider like?
Well, it depends. It's a lot of travel. So I think in the first year there were 4 of us in a van that we converted into a sort of had, you know, the seats at the front and a couple of seats at the back, and then we converted all the back into a living space. So you get to know, you choose your travel buddies very wisely. You get to know them very well. And it pretty much starts off on a Wednesday. You might be doing an exhibition rodeo somewhere, or it depends what time of the year. I was around Calgary, so the Calgary Stampede, there was lots of exhibition rodeos for that. And then you've got a rodeo on a Thursday. Then you might have one on a Friday morning, and then you've got to drive 5 hours to get to another one on Friday afternoon, and then you have one on Saturday morning, then you've got to drive another 5 hours. Like, we'd go all the way up to Northwest Territories, like up, you know, like right up north. I've been rodeo up there in the middle of summer when it's snowing. Like, it's pretty wild territory. And then, yeah, sometimes you'd do 6 to 8 rodeos in a weekend. And then you'd finish that on a Sunday, and then I'd break in horses Monday, Tuesday. It wasn't a very good breaking system because I'd get on them for a couple of days and then I'd take off for a week's rodeoing again. So I'd have to play catch up with pretty much these unbroken horses again on a Monday. But that was a great experience. And then I broke my leg pretty badly and I sort of had to sit on the sideline for 2 years. And by the time I got back into it, I radioed out a little bit here in Australia, but then I was like, you know, this is, I'm done. It's too long out of the saddle. And it's sort of one of those things. It's not like you go and play a practice game of polo this weekend if you haven't been riding for 2 years. When you get on a bronc and crack the chute, it's on. It's not, there's no going slow.
What age were you then?
I started when I was late 20s, so I got into it very late. Yeah, and then I sort of pulled the pin when I was early 30s.
And so you basically, like you say, you pulled the pin on the rodeo, and then what was the next step from there?
While I was sort of healing with a broken leg, I got into a few other things. I got into the restaurant game, and I went and lived in New York for a couple of years and didn't touch a horse and managed restaurants and opened restaurants in New York.
Did you say you got into the drug game?
Restaurant game.
Ah, restaurant game, sorry.
Yeah, so I had a complete shift in life from horses to restaurants living in New York, and I didn't see or touch a horse for 2 years.
So how do you go from, being a rodeo rider in Australia to opening restaurants in New York? I know we're not talking a lot about horses, but this is, how do you do that?
Good question. Well, my brother lived in New York because he's in the meat industry, and I was, I was in Canada, so I went to visit him in New York, and then I said, why not? I've got a visa. I might as well stay. So I stayed there, and I thought, right, well, I'll get a job here and stay for a while. And then I went to this restaurant that lots of Australians worked at, that he knew a guy that knew a guy. I worked there for a couple of days, and they said, hey, do you want to – we've got a chain of restaurants. Do you want to manage them? And I was like, sure. So it just sort of happened completely out of chance. I went to visit my brother for a week and ended up staying there for 2 years.
Righto. How did you get into breaking in?
Yeah. Yeah, Ross has run out of patience. Ross has run out of patience here. Seamlessly segueing back into the horses. Thanks, Ross.
I want to know his methods. So that's I'm trying to get a segue into the methods.
That's timely, Ross. So thank you for that. Okay. So Marty, talk us a little bit how you got into breaking horses, and talk us through a little bit of your system, mate.
Yeah, no more about the restaurants, okay?
Yeah, we'll do the restaurants another time.
Let's get into the breaking inside, into the secrets. I'd sort of always broken in my own horses and done a little bit of it, and I'd done a fair bit of it in Canada. But I was just breaking in ranch horses, so it wasn't, and I was sort of doing different things, and I'd broken in all the different types of horses there. And then I was actually moving to Europe like 4 years ago, and then I was on my way to Beltrees to break some horses in. And I got a call from a thoroughbred stud in Victoria saying, hey, do you want to come and break in some horses? And I said, oh, yeah, how many? And they said, oh, about 60. I was like, right, I could do it. So I shuffled a few things around. I came to Victoria and I broke in the 60, went to Beltrees. And then the borders closed with COVID, so I couldn't get to Europe. So I ended up staying here and then ended up calling the stud back, and I was like, hey, I'm still in Australia. Do you want me to pre-train your racehorses? So I came back down to Victoria and got into the pre-training, and then I sort of just stayed in that system and grew it from there. And then now we're into year four of that. And yeah, we've sort of got anywhere of around about 30 breakers in at a time is sort of our number. And we start in November. And we finish about the end of June. So
that's for one outfit. All those horses are coming from one outfit.
I'd say 80% of them are owned by those, and 80% and the other 20% are owned by, you know, their clients that spell their horses with them. I have a few. That's one major one. Then I've got a few others that, you know, I might do 50 for one guy and 50 for another guy. But yeah, I've got one very good big client and a few other little ones.
I'm very conscious of Ross's attention span. So talk us through the actual process that you've now, you spent a number of years sort of leading up to and then refining. Oh, yeah, sorry, Ross. Sorry.
Yeah, talk us through that, but also let us know how they turn up. Like what state are they in when they turn up? What sort of prep have they done before they come to you and stuff like that?
That's literally what I was going to ask.
See, we are one, Nick, mate.
That's beautiful, isn't it? It's just I love it. So, Marty, what sort of condition do they turn up in? I think is what we'd like to know. And then talk us through your process. Is that the question I should have asked, Ross?
Yeah, that's a fine question, Nick, mate.
Oh, I'm on fire tonight.
You've peaked.
It's all downhill. All downhill from here.
We get about 50-50 of that have been through sales preps, and some of those may not have sold. So the stud might have had, you know, they've got a draft of 20 horses in the sale, for example. 10 of those may not have sold, so then they come back to the stud and I break them in, and then the stud either retains them and races them, or then they sell them as broken in trialed horses. The other 10...
What's the sales prep?
Oh, so all the yearling sales. So the yearling sales start here in the Gold Coast at the start of January, and they go through, then they're sort of every, you know, couple of weeks from the start of January until the last major one is on this weekend in Sydney, and Winks is, Foal's actually selling it, that one. So they're where all the yearlings.
Who's that by?
Piero. Huh. Yeah, so interesting to see what
we should bid on that.
What do you reckon it'll go for, Marty?
No one's saying a price, but I think it's going to be pretty, you know, there's going to be a couple of big players in there. Some of these big studs that, you know, buy these well-bred broodmares, and it'd be great to see her go to Waller, and, you know, he could train the daughter as well. So, you know, I'm sure it's all organised, and he's got his team ready to pounce and buy her, and, yeah, I think a lot of money. It's hard to say.
More than $10.
Well, NRG should put in a bid.
Let's do it.
Basically, with the horses that arrive to me, you know, I get a very good blend of the untouched horses, and most of my previous experience of breaking in is untouched horses. So I've, you know, some of the horses I broke in Canada and the US were 6, 8, 10-year-old stallions that people had decided to turn into ranch horses. So these things have, like, I've broken out everything from Clydesdales to quarter horses to paints to donkeys to mules, everything that have been stallions or never touched in their life, and broken them in to make them into riding horses. So that's given me a lot of experience of how to deal with those untouched horses. And then now I do a lot of, most of mine now, probably 80% of the horses I get, handled, but I do still get a lot that aren't, like yesterday, I had a load of 6 fillies turn up that literally is straight out of the paddock. You know, they've been caught a couple of times, have their feet trimmed, but no handling, so to speak. So it's very different dealing with those. The ones from the, and you guys would all know this, it's about what handling they've had. And sometimes the horses that have had so much handling, they are the worst ones to deal with because they've had the wrong handling. And it's a pretty common thread that happens with those horses. You can tell it straight away. They walk in the ramp pen and they just want to walk straight over top of you. They have no respect. They've been babied too much. So you've got to approach it very different with those ones. You've got to go back to, you've got to actually sort of try and make them into that untouched horse a little bit, like do some steps that are going, right, oh, well, I've got to get you away from me. Instead of the untouched horses, I want them to connect with me instead of their mates. But these horses that have been handled so much and handled a little bit too, you know, softly or too many pats and too many feeds, I've actually got to get them off me and disconnect from me a little bit to go, oh, okay, well, I've got to respect this guy. So it's a very different process there. So the ones that I get that are unhandled, my first approach with them is, if you think of a horse that's call it two. So it's been running around the paddock for 2 years with its mates, you know, whether it's got 10 mates in the paddock or 20. So it's never actually been separated from that mob properly and, you know, connecting with a human. So I get them. They all come in on day one. We scan them in. They've all got microchips. We send videos to all the owners, update them that they've arrived, and then I just leave them in their stables for that day. And there's a lot of whinnying and, you know, pushing against stable walls and everything because they're not able to touch their friends. So that's sort of the first disconnect for those horses. And then the next day I take them into the ram pen and I will put one into the ram pen. I've got two ram pens. And I'll put two in ram pens and I'll leave them there for half an hour and I'll go ride some other horses. And just the whinnying and I sort of just leave them to their own devices, because if I try and get in there and break that horse in straight away when I put it into the ram pen, it can sort of not really even see its mates. It's no point. It wants nothing to do with me and it just wants to run over top of me and everything. So I really let the horse sort of train itself for half an hour. I go and ride another horse. I come back, and then by that stage, that horse has stopped its wheeling, stopped its carrying on, and then I've actually got its attention and a bit of focus on me.
Marty, I probably should have asked this 3 minutes ago, but we will have people that are listening that do a lot of handling of their young ones, and I guess what we're calling it is probably overhandling. I'm going back a step. How do we try to say to them, how do we explain to them not to overhandle? You know, it's their first horse or it's their one horse and they're loving it and they're cuddling it. And as you say, they become a bit too friendly and sort of want to walk all over the top of you. And people think that they're doing the right thing, but yeah, they've also got to have respect. So what can we do to, yeah, what do you reckon?
I think we need to clear up the narrative on that. I don't think overhandling is the right terminology, because you can do as much good handling as you want. If it's good handling and good clear communication, concise communication, it's only going to build a better platform. It's handling them poorly or handling them without understanding what you're really trying to achieve.
Yes. How can we do that? What can we put out there to give them, you know, I mean, I know this is about a 30-hour podcast, but are there some pretty basics we could do?
There's some very basics. You know, the biggest, the most common problem I get is, like, you put a halter on them and you go to lead the horse or back the horse away from you, and you try and back it up and all it wants to do is push into the pressure and come over top of you and things like that. So someone with even no knowledge, the first thing I do with these horses, I put a halter on and I just let them, I've got rope halters with the lead fully attached, it's safe. I just let them walk around dragging the halter lead around. So they train themselves, they learn to step on the halter lead, they learn to back themselves up and everything. So that's simple that someone with no actual training knowledge can do. And then something else that, you know, a lot of people that are, you know, handling these horses incorrectly, so to speak, is just literally, I guess there's that line of respect. It's like when a person's with you, you need your own space. So they've just got to teach that horse that you don't need to step on my toes, you don't need to walk over top of me. If people just taught their horses to give them the same space that like when you're standing there to your human, that, and to be able to back up off a halter and if I give you a click, I want you to move. And those are very basic things. You've got a whole different horse when they come in, because they're all – very rarely I'll get a horse that wants to bite me, strike me, kick me and chase me out of the ramp, and it happens. And obviously they're the ones that have been, you know, mistreated. The rest of them are all just ignorant. They just want to walk over top of you because they've been fed and patted. So – That's a very simple thing to do. Just let them go to ramp and walking around dragging a halter, because they soon learn to step on that halter lead and back up, and that's the start of the giving to pressure and getting away from you. So with those untouched ones, so then, you know, I really just work on that that day one. It's amazing. You would think a horse would be able to walk into a ramp and lunge. You know, you'd think, you're right, if you hold the halter lead here and you sort of push it away, you'd be able to move that horse around. But it's amazing, the horses, young horses get stuck very easily. Like they have a problem moving. You know, even when you ride young horses, the biggest challenge is with the young horses, just getting them to move somewhere and go straight and be free. Same thing when you're teaching these young horses to lunge. So it's a really fine line of pressure, too much pressure on and not enough pressure. So I spent a lot of time on that day one just getting that horse literally bending to me. So I'll go and, you know, I'll teach it to lunge. I want it to move. First thing I want to do is want it to move around. And I'm really big on where I'm positioning my body, and I always use a little lunge whip, and I'll direct that. Everything I do on the ground, I want to be replicated for when I get on the horse. So my lunge whip will be pointed towards the ribs, so I'm like replicating when I get on that horse. That's the pressure from the ribs. Every time I want a horse to move, it'll be a click. So when I get on it, I don't have to kick it. I give it a click and it goes up. I was taught on the ground, when I click, I move. So I really want to work on those first sessions of really getting that horse soft. And, you know, I'm strong enough to pull them around if I have to, and occasionally you do have to pull them around, but I want to work with the horse's head so it realizes that when it releases from that pressure that I'm giving it to it, it's an instant release from me and me releasing that pressure. So like you've seen in join-up videos, you know, when you take a halter off a horse and you work it around, you're looking for the signs of putting enough pressure on that horse, and you're looking for the signs of it, you know, chew, drop its head, lift its tail, all those sort of things, and then it will come to you. So I want to do that with the halter lead so that as it's going around and all those signs are happening, I'm picking it up with that little bit of pressure on its halter lead, and I'm just stepping forward, bit of pressure, and then I'm stepping back and releasing that pressure. So it's a bit, I don't know whether it's hard to, without, you know, visualizing it, but I'm very big on that, getting that horse connected to me like that. And then I spend a lot of time just standing beside the horse, and I'll bend its head around, and I just go with it until the horse just literally stops and bends, releases to that pressure. And then once it's released to the pressure, I'll give it a pat, and then I'll step away from the horse at sort of a 45-degree angle, and then I'll make it move, you know, I'll click it and get it to come forward with me. And it's probably easy to explain that. If I'm sitting on the horse and I'm teaching it to turn, I'm riding it, and I want to bend its head to the left, I want it to, you know, be soft and come to the left and just, you know, flex its head, and then I'll go, right, and now we're going to turn. So then I'll change and I'll put my right leg on it and make it move. So I'm doing that exact same process on the ground. Everything I do on the ground is then easy for when I get on the horse's back. So the process from an untouched horse to all these horses coming from the sales is exactly the same once I get that horse disconnected from all its mates. So then we go on to the stages of the, you know, putting a roller on the horse, a bit on the horse. I do put hobbles on all of my horses. And for the simple fact that before I put the hobbles on, they've dragged a halter lead around, so they've actually learnt to release to pressure, not fight pressure. And I've got a big, very big, thick cotton rope, and I'll put it on the horse's legs and I'll lead the horse with its legs. So I want to teach that horse to come forward to me with pressure from its legs so I can literally lead it by its feet. And I just think by doing that, it really teaches a horse to respect the farrow. And I'm not pulling on the horse's head to lead it. I'm just literally pressure on its legs, getting it to step forward to me. And then also I've found horses stuck in fences before with their foot just sitting there waiting. And a horse that hasn't been taught to respect hobbles that will be led with their feet, I've also seen them pull out of a fence and rip their feet off. Yes, Ross?
Yeah, not only that, if they end up upside down in a truck and they've never been restrained and lived through it, they can they panic because in the, you know, their 2-million-year-old brain thinks the saber-toothed tiger's going to eat it.
Yeah, and we've talked a bit about hobbles, and I've never used hobbles. I don't have any experience of hobbles, and they look and I'm interested in your experience, and I know you're doing it sort of commercially, but you know, hobbles just look very extreme to me.
So does getting on a horse's back. That's pretty extreme, you know. I think it's a matter of, it's like if you go and put a saddle on a horse's back, you're going to get an extreme reaction. But if you set the horse up for the saddle going on its back and educate it and do it as a process, it's not that extreme, and it's a pretty nice controlled situation. Yeah. And hobbles are the same thing. Like if you just go throw some hobbles on a horse that's never had them and never had any prep and you haven't set them up for it, you can get a pretty, you know, same as putting saddle on, you can get a pretty, big reaction. But if you set them up,
I 100% understand, and that's why I was sort of caveating that with it. I don't have experience of how to lead up to that process, and I've seen. Yeah, I don't have experience of leading up to that process, and it makes me a little bit uncomfortable because I don't know. I've not had a great deal of exposure to that, but as you're saying, Ross, if you set a horse up with a saddle wrong, that can look extreme. So we'll probably end up cutting this bit out because I'm not.
No, I think we should keep it in. Because imagine just.
I'm not talking from a position of experience at all.
Oh, don't cut it out. It's a good conversation. And
so this is an emotional response rather than something that's based in any form of knowledge.
Yeah, but I reckon this is half the reason. This is the best thing about our podcast is we have different perspectives and we chew it over. And our listeners have different perspectives, so they'll be like, oh, I hadn't thought of it like that. But if you put a cart behind a horse day one, hooked it up and let it go, can you imagine what the reaction would be?
And
hobbles are not even nearly as crazy as tying a move like a vehicle with four wheels behind to a horse's ass end. You know what I mean?
Or if you jump on it with a stick and try to chase a ball with a whole load of other people trying to kill you, you know, doing that at the wrong stage, that horse is going to go inside out. So no, I 100% get it. My point is, it looks, if done wrong.
That's a good topic.
You're right in what you're saying. It's like everything that we're doing. So I've got, we're breaking in 30 at a time. We'll break in at least 300 this season. And out of those 300, I might get, there might be one or two that cause us an issue. You know, it might be one or two that buck because we've got a system. And I've always learning it. I'm always going, well, why am I doing it that way? Why don't I do this? And then that can take out that step. Because when you're breaking in that many horses, you've got to have a very good system. You've got to run out the horse in rampant one. It's sitting there with the roller on and the bit in it, getting used to that. I'm going to go and work on horse two. And if I miss any of those steps, we've got some problems. So I don't have the luxury of spending hours and hours on one horse. And all these horses that I'm working with, they are babies. Like I'm dealing with these race horses, they're breaking them in at sort of 18 months old, if that. So I'm dealing with like if you convert that to human years, I'm dealing with like an 8 or a 9-year-old child. So I need to be very, very clear on what I do, and I need to keep it short and sharp because their attention span's so short. So like with the hobbles, with putting a saddle on, with putting a bit on, there's a whole prep to it. So I don't just get a saddle and throw it on. So, you know, I'll put the hobbles on, but I've already prepped it for those hobbles and I never get a reaction from the hobbles. They might take a step and hit them and they're like, oh, okay, release to that pressure. The horses have to learn pressure because at some point they will have pressure. Like I said, in a truck, these horses have to go in barriers, polo horses have to go in lineouts. You know, they're stopped, they're turned. If they don't learn that pressure early on in their life, that's when you get problems with these horses that when they do receive some pressure down the track, they can't handle it. I always have two horses working at the same time because I have to for numbers-wise, but a horse can teach itself a lot of things if you're doing it correctly. So I'll put the hobbles on, I'll bag the horse down, I'll do things with it. And then I do a lot of work with tarps on the ground. So that's one prepping from one day. They will see a tarp on the ground, they'll see a rug on the ground, they'll see something on the ground. And I've ridden so many old horses that if they see a tarp on the ground, they just about die because they've never been exposed to it. So I'm a big believer in exposing them to as much as I can, controlled. So I'll put a tarp on the ground. I'll keep it a couple of metres off the round pen wall, and I'll make it very narrow. So I'll sort of roll it up into a cylinder, and I'll lunge the horse past that tarp both ways so I can see it out of both eyes and from both sides. And then I'll, as the horse is not worried about it, I'll slowly move that tarp closer and closer to the wall to the point where the horse is jumping over the tarp, still rolled in the cylinder, so it's not a big, scary object. And then I'll slowly start spreading the tarp out. And that's like everything that we're doing. You know, if I just put that tarp in there and spread it out on a big tarp and try to get the horse to run over it, the horse would want to jump out of the rampant. So it's a process of going, right, well, I'm not just going to do that because I don't want to scare that horse because then I've got to fix the problem. So I don't let it become a problem in the first place. So they never think the tarp's scary because nothing scared them. I've introduced it in a way of going, well, that was easy. I ran past it. It didn't kill me. I ran over top of it, all rolled up. It didn't get me. And then within a couple of minutes, that horse is walking over it, you know, wanting to bite it, play with it, because you've introduced it in those steps.
Yeah, we glossed over it very quickly. You talked about introducing the bits to the horse. How do you go about doing that? Because I've seen that done in lots of different ways, and I'm interested to understand how you introduce the horse to the bit.
Yeah, look, I think putting a bit on the horse for the first time is very important because if there's two things that can go wrong. You can either have the bit, the bridle, way too short, and you put it on a horse for the first time and you've got to rip this bit up high in its mouth and pull it over its ears, and a lot of people just don't even look at the horse's head and go, right, well, that's the horse with a big head. Let's make it big and put it on so it's comfortable for the horse. So there's that. They put it on and it's too tight, so you've got a horse sitting there with his bit, you know, cranked up in its mouth, and you've just about had to cut its ears off to get the bit on the horse's head. Or they put it on and they leave it too loose, and the horse learns to put it tongue over the bit in session one. The first time we introduce any of these things to the horses is so important, because if they don't learn a bad experience, have a bad experience, or learn a bad habit, you don't have to fix it. So I'm very conscious of everything I do. I do it correctly so that the horse has a good experience. So I never have a problem putting a bit on a horse. If I'm on the near side, I hold the bit up in my left hand and I just put my right hand over the horse's head, and I'll open the horse's mouth with my fingers so I'm not pulling the bit into its teeth. So when I put the bit in, it's for the first time, it's easy. And then I've sort of gauged the size of the horse's head, put the bit on, then I'll adjust it, and then I don't touch it. I just let the horse sit there and chew on that bit, and that's when I'll go to the other round pen.
What sort of bit?
So to start off with, I'll just use like a normal little snaffle, like a ring snaffle. Just then there's no risk of it getting caught on anything, and it's got a bit of string underneath it so it can't slide anywhere in the horse's mouth. And it's just literally a bridle with just a basic bridle, nothing. So nice little easy ring snaffle, and then I'll convert that from when I start putting pressure on the bit to a Tom Thumb. And I want the Tom Thumb because I just find with those babies, it's just so much easier for them to understand when they've got that extra support and pressure on the outside with the bars. That's I never used to use Tom Thumbs as much, but then I started to, and I just found these babies, they just worked it out so much faster when they had that pressure from the Tom Thumb. And then once I get riding them, then I'll mix it up. I'll put them in a Tom Thumb, I'll put them in a snaffle, I'll put them in all different bits, because when they get to the track, they'll have tongue plates on, they'll have everything, you know. So we mix it up. We expose them to everything once I get riding them.
Hey, how long have you got these for?
4 weeks.
That's pretty quick. And then do you get the re-rides?
Yeah, so, yep, 4 weeks in. And look, that can alter a few days here and there, but it's pretty much 4 weeks to the day 99% of the time. Then they go to the paddock for a minimum of 4 weeks, sometimes longer.
And what are you doing with them at the end of 4 weeks? Like, what's the bar?
They're going through the barriers. They're jumping out of the barriers slowly, but they're jumping out. And they're my sort of, when I know they're ready, I can ride them in a pair in groups of threes or fours, and they can learn to really bump each other. And let's say we're in a group of three. I want the outside horses to try and squash that middle horse, because you've seen it in racing, young horses or even old horses get a bit of a bump and they just fall out the back. And a polo horse?
No, they melt, yeah.
Yeah, they're just not, their confidence goes, they just lose it. So once I can put them in a pad, they can go out by themselves. We do lots of dressage with the race horses. Every second day is dressage. And we'll nearly finish every ride every day with a minute or two of dressage. But I know when they're ready to go home, and they go out of the barriers, they're in a pad.
Marty, when you say dressage, do you mean like a flat work, collecting them up in circles? Is that what you're referring
to?
Right.
Can we just go back a step? Because I put us off track by talking about the bridle. We didn't talk about the process of saddling up and backing.
Yeah, so once I've taught them to lunge and go past the tarp, and then once they've walked over top of the tarp, if they're standing on a tarp playing with it, they have no problem with that tarp going on their back. So that's their sort of first time if they're an unhandled horse, they've had something on their back. So then I put the tarp all over them. I literally put the tarp completely over their head and everything. So that horse has really got to trust me. So they can't see me. They can only hear me. Put that tarp completely over. And once you've done that with the horse, if you've done all the steps right to get to that point, you can pretty much do anything to it. So then I'll get the saddle cloth. They don't care about a saddle cloth because they've just had a tarp over their head. The roller goes on. All of our rollers have elastic sides on the girth as well, so we're never, at risk of really cranking it up too much on those horses. And they might have a bit of a hump around the first time, but the process is very, very uneventful. Like there's no rodeos, there's no action. So they'll spend a couple of days in the roller. With the roller on, and actually received a flash new roller from Ross, which is very good. We're using it every single day. And once they've got past the chewing point with the bit, and they're just accepting the roller, and this is sort of now we're into about day three, then I'll start to put a little bit of pressure on the bit. And the first steps to that are we'll connect a clip from the bit through the roller with an elastic. And this sort of happens for day one. And we want to do the elastic just so I've seen horses without the elastic and they hit that pressure and their first reaction is to rear and potentially flip over. So just for that initial day one, that first day, of the pressure, which is about day three, I'll use the elastic, and as soon as the horse releases from that pressure, it comes off, and it might be 30 seconds, 1 minute, it might be 10 seconds. I don't want the horse sitting there releasing the pressure and sitting there bending its neck around. That's using a lot of muscles, and eventually if you leave it there for too long, it will have to go back and lean onto that bit because its neck gets tight.
Yeah.
So then you're teaching the horse to lean against pressure. So that can be a very fast process. And once the horse is not fighting that, I try not to use the elastic anymore because the elastic has movement. So you can teach a horse very quickly to move, pull, release against pressure. So the racehorse mouthing system is very different to the polo system. I want these racehorses to go along with their head, not touching their chest, but pretty close to it. And be sitting in my hands and going forward into that bit, complete opposite of what we want a polo horse, don't polo horse, we want to be riding loose reins. When we pick them up, there's a reaction. These racehorses, I have to teach them to be going around very comfortably and very laterally into the bit. So what I'll do is I'll put a lunge line and I'll put it through one of the rings of the roller connected to the bit, and I'll get that horse, if I'm lunging that horse anti-clockwise and I'm on its near side, then I'll be pushing it, the pressure onto its ribcage and with my right hand, and then my left hand I'll be picking up on that lunge line and flexing that horse's head to the left. And that's the first steps that we use to get a horse to accept pressure and going forward into the bit is laterally. If I can get them soft laterally, I can get them soft going forward into the bit with pressure on both reins. But I've got to get the rib cage soft. So it's a lot of pressure from me,
yep,
like my leg, pretending that me pushing on that left hand, that near side rib cage is like my left leg when I'm riding them. So we do a lot of that. Get them super soft laterally. Then once I've got them soft laterally in the mouthing process, then I'll get another clip with a rope and I'll connect that to the outside of the horse. So if I'm lunging the horse still anti-clockwise, it's clear for me. I'm not sure if it's clear, sounding clear, not visualizing. Yeah. Then I'll have that, and I've got to set that so the horse can just bend its head inside the circle a little bit so that when it bends its head too far to the left, it hits the pressure on the right-hand side. And then I'm still using that inside rope where I can gauge the pressure. So then I've got the horse moving forward, and the more I bend the horse's head to the left, it's also engaging the pressure from the right-hand rein because I've got that connected on the offside of the horse. So then the horse has to put its head down and move, and then I can move it forward. And I'm doing all of this before riding it so that it learned. It's so much easier to teach this on the ground, moving forward into, yeah, that pressure there like that. So once I've got a horse nicely doing that, I drive them. So I still drive all of my horses, long riding them. And then we're at the end of week one by then. So at the end, you know, the horse is ready to ride. I introduce a lead horse. And the biggest thing I find with any horse that's going to bark or bolt or anything like that when you first get on it is basically, well, there's a couple of reasons. Either you haven't done the preparation correctly. Two, it's never seen a person above them, so they get a fright. And three, it's never felt the weight or, you know, had someone over them, leaning over them. So I do that on the lead horse. So I bring the lead horse into the round pen and I'll just lead them around off both sides on the lead horse until they're completely comfortable just to be beside me. And most of the time they are very quickly with all the prep work we've done. And I'll lean over the saddle and I'll tap them on the bum, tap them on the neck, rub them around the head. And that can be a one-minute process or a five-minute process depending on the horse. Lead horse goes out, rider comes in. And this is where we do come back to the hobbles a little bit. They've already been taught to stand completely still. So in every process I do, I want that horse to completely stand still. And I'm not holding it still. It's on a loose lead. If it doesn't want to stand still, it goes to work. And I make it work to teach it that standing still is the comfortable spot. So then one person will be on the ground with a lunge lead. Person will get on if that horse goes to move at all. And if it really wants to move, I'll just throw the hobbles back on and instantly that horse knows to stand still. So that first time we get on the horse, I want it to know, without any pressure, me holding it, bending its head, it can, a person get on. We rarely have to do that, but that's, I was just saying that we've already taught the horse to stand still with the hobbles. Sometimes I will have to put the hobbles on a horse again to do that, to go stand still. Because I don't want to be restraining these horses, and that, if we go back to the original, like right at the start of this, you're like, what's the main problem you see with horses coming in that have been handled a lot? A big problem I have, if unless I'm actually stopping that horse from doing something, it won't stand still, it won't do this, it won't do this, because they've been forced to do everything. The horse hasn't actually been taught, I want you to stand there, I want you to turn left, I want you to turn right, on a loose rein, because it's been held and it's been made to do everything. So I want the horse to be, if I don't ask you to move, don't move. stand there on a loose lead. So then the rider gets on, and the person on the ground is literally just leading that horse left to right, nice big turn, so it's not getting all too tight in its, you know, turns. And then he lunges that horse around the ramp, and the person on the ground, I just find it so much easier with the person on the ground, because the person riding the horse can literally just sit there, talk to the horse, pat it. It's not having to kick or turn or anything like that. The person on the ground's creating that energy, moving the horse. Do that for a couple of minutes, but then I unhook the horse, and then the rider takes over and the rider starts turning.
So initially that rider on top is just a passenger. It's not actually giving any signal.
No, not for the first couple of minutes. And then I unclip the horse, and then the rider takes control. And I'm still in there on the ground, and I'll get the rider to turn left, and I'll step around and I'll help push the horse. So it's just easy. And that horse learns on that first ride that very little pressure, it's turning left, because I'm on the ground sort of moving that horse around.
And what sort of time frame are we looking at for this first ride? Are we talking about day two, day three, end of the first week?
We're in week two. So because I'm breaking in so many at a time, when I used to just break in one or two, I'd be riding them on day one, because I could spend, you know, and that's just how I sort of thought it was to be done. But the reason I don't anymore is a couple of reasons. Is we have a lot to get through, but also these racehorses I'm dealing with now, they're so developed for such young horses. You know, they're as big as a three-year-old horse size-wise, but they've still got very open knees, open joints. Like, there's a lot of potential for problems if I get on that horse too soon and there's a rodeo or there's some problems, because the horse is so underdeveloped in its joints. So I want to make sure 100% that when we get on it that first time, there's no issues, and there isn't if we do that process. So we're middle of week two in this process. So that's the ride for the first day, just in the round pen, and then the rider will grab a tarp and literally trot around the round pen, can around the ramp pen, wiping the horse down with the tarp, waving a tarp all around, and it's already had this, so I do that again on the first ride. And the reason I do it on the first ride is I want to expose them to all those things, because one day someone will pick up a tarp, someone will pick up an umbrella, someone will pick up something. So if we don't do it then, if I wait and do it in the second prep, it's a problem for that horse, because it's like, well, you've done all these other things with me and now you're picking up that tarp. But on day one, they don't care.
How long is the second prep?
1 month as well, basically. Because after the second prep...
What's the gap between the breaking in and the second prep normally?
4 to 6 weeks. We aim for 4. And then the second prep is very important for me to try and get them out the door at 4 weeks, because from there they go to the racetrack. And they'll go to the racetrack for a week, maybe 2 weeks. But If I keep that horse in for too long, much longer than 4 weeks, mentally and physically they're getting a little bit, because they're so young, that by the time they get to the track, they're a little bit over it. So it's a very fine line on me saying, you know, sometimes I'll send them at week three, I'll be like, this horse is really ready to go, but I think this horse doesn't have much longer left. So let's get it to the track now for a quick look while it's still willing and still fresh before I send it there sour. And sometimes they don't get there, that second prep.
So, Marty, we often talk about this too, you know, the signs of a horse that's a bit going about to get sour and stuff like that. What would you consider to tell people of horses that are about to get sour or not feeling good? What are those signs?
Well, the first signs, because all of our horses are stable, the first signs is, you know, that we see is a change in that horse. When you go in to feed it or clean it stable, it's like ears back, not happy. That can mean multiple things, but normally if you've got a happy horse that you're seeing every day, and then straight away there's that. That's the first sign of a problem, and it might not be the sourness, it might be they're sore or something's wrong with them, but that's sort of the first sign. And then the major sign when we go to ride them out is that horse just doesn't want to go anywhere. It's like if it's been going fine, straight for me one day, and then the next day it's swishing its tail and it's kicking up and not wanting to go. It's either sore or it's like, I'm young and I've had enough. So it's my job, and from experience, I can see that. I'm like, righto, well, we need to finish this horse, but we need to finish it on a good note. I don't want to send it to the paddock when it's gone out here and pig-rooted and swished its tail, where yesterday it was completely fine, and I don't want to get off it then and go, okay, go and have a reward and go in the paddock. So then I'll go and do something with it, and whether it be, you know, a complete different ride or something, so that I can finish it then on a good note, and it can go to the paddock for a month, or it might only need to go to the paddock for a couple of weeks, quick freshen up, and then come back to me. So it's a matter of getting it early. You've got to, I guess, have the experience to notice the tiny little change and go, we need to change its workup. It's sick of going around the track doing track work. Let's not go to the barriers again. It's done it right. So I think the biggest mistake that a lot of people can make is doing too much of the same thing. It's like a lot of people will say the most boring part of their day is driving the same path to work every day. Well, go a different way, you know. So when we go out on these young horses, you know, we've got the option of a bush ride, we've got the option of a racetrack, we've got the option of a dam bank wall, we've got an option of dressage. We've got an option of going clockwise around the track, anti-clockwise. We'll do it differently every single day. So when we go out, one, it's fresh for the riders. Two, it's fresh for the horse. It's like, well, it's not repetitious. We're going to do something different today.
I don't know, because you're dealing with horses that haven't had a lot of training. Have you ever had horses that have come to you that have been taught the basic manoeuvres through that associate it with stress or anxiety, or they're hot? And how do you deal with something that's been taught the maneuvers through an unpleasant experience? How do you make it a pleasant experience? And then the second one is, how do you deal with horses that people have got used to them shutting down? They've misconstrued that horse standing still and listening to you with being shut down, so they increasingly become shut down. That's their go-to.
What do you mean shut down? You mean like frozen? Or
yeah, you know, when that horse just basically, that horse is just, it's just gone to its happy place, the eyes glaze over, it's just like, I'm just gonna stand here and I'm just gonna zone you out in the hope that, because I see this a lot with people that go, I'm gonna desensitize this horse. And that horse isn't desensitized. It's just completely just zoning you out. And I'm just going to wait till you do your thing and go away. And then I'm going to come back to reality, rather than I'm desensitized and I'm engaged with you. I'm thinking about stuff.
Yeah, quite right.
But it's not a problem.
Yeah.
So horses that have been taught to deal with stress by shutting down, How do you get
them? I know how those horses feel. That's how I was at 2 a.m. Decent.
I'm getting to that stage right now.
But not stress. Yeah, look, we do get a lot of those horses, Nick. Like, we get a lot of the older horses that I've never seen or touched that have been to the racetrack and raced a lot, and then they'll either have problems with the barriers or problems with – when what I thought you meant from shutting down is, yeah, literally stopping and just not wanting to go. And you can see those signs in those horses very quickly. If you've got a horse trotting around or cantering around, and you can see the signs, and I reckon I look for straight away in those front legs. As soon as those front legs start to get a bit stiff and come off the ground in a stiff sort of fashion, the next thing that is going to happen instantly is it is going to want to stop and rear. And the first thing 99.9% of people do is pull on the reins. More rein contact, and I'm complete opposite. I try and explain it to them like this. Pretend you're pushing a car, a broken down car, and you're pushing it along, and it's very hard to get it started. Once you need two people. Once you've got it rolling, a kid can basically move it because you've already got it in motion, and it's in motion, so keep the motion. People try and stop the motion.
Momentum's your friend, yeah.
Oh, 100%. And I think that isn't taught enough because everyone just wants to use their reins. And I'm like, let go of your reins, forget about your reins, and move the horse. If you've got a horse that's anxious, like you said, Nick, and got problems when you're riding it, the worst thing you can do is try and make the horse stand still. If someone rides away from you and you're by yourself and the horse is carrying on, if you try and make that horse stand still, you will get killed. The horse will eventually rear or do something, move it. Like, it is so simple just to go, right, now, let's walk around the circle. Let's trot here. Let's do a figure of eight. Let's motion, motion, motion. And then you've got the horse doing two things. It's moving. So that's what it wanted to do. It wanted to move. So move it. And if you're turning it right, then left, and a bit of a click here and a bit of there, never trying to stop it in that motion, it's actually thinking about you instead of its mate that's just left it. And it's got this whole separation anxiety going on. The problems that I see with horses are so simple to fix. And that's probably my, if I was to pick the one thing that I'm probably best at in all of the horse breaking in or the training is identifying a problem and fixing it very quickly. Because I've seen so many different horses and I've tried so many different ways and I've learned from mistakes and I've taught myself. Mostly no one has come to me and said, which I do to my staff now, do this, do this, do this, do this. I've learned it the hard way myself, going, well, shit, that didn't work. Oh, that worked. But motion is, as Ross said, motion is your friend. It's like momentum. So the anxiety of a horse, you've got to think like it. And once again, I revert everything back to children. That young horse is like a little kid. You've got its attention for a very short period of time. If you're, pretend you're at a crossroad, yeah, and you're going to cross the road with a kid, and you're trying to, if you are hanging on to that, every time you cross the road, if you hold on to that kid and go, I'm going to hold you so you don't walk across the road, when you're not there and you let go of it, it's going to cross the road and get run over. But if you teach it, stand still, this is the good spot, stand still here with me and then we'll cross the road together. So I think exactly like that with my young horses. I'm like, right, if I hold you tight, right, you're going to eventually have a problem. When I let go of you, you're going to do what you want. But if I teach you that being here with me is the safe spot and then we'll go together, it works. So
that's the key.
100%. I think dealing with problem horses, I love it. Like, I love dealing with problem horses. I look at it, but the first thing that I do is I go, okay, what, why is that horse a problem? So, for example, I'll give you a very simple example, right? I've got a little filly that Glenn dropped off a while ago and sassy little thing. And day one, day two, you know, I'd pat her on the back or pat her on the belly and she'd try and bite me and kick me. And I was like, bloody Glenn, what have you given me here? And then initially the first day I was like, oh, this horse is bloody, you know, scared of this. And then one of my staff was doing it the next day and she's like, oh, mate, this horse is, you know, really scared. It's trying to kick me in the bite. And I was watching it and I was like, that horse is not scared. So it's identifying very quickly, is the horse scared? Is the horse being a brat? So straight away I was like, that horse has been a brat.
Yeah.
So all I simply did was every time it went to kick or do anything, I was like, work, lunge this way, lunge that way. Okay, come back to me now. I'll do it again. You want to kick? Lunge this way, lunge that way. I just made the horse work. Every time there was a problem, within 5 minutes, had a tarp on that horse, had a roll on that horse, and it's never kicked again. But for 2 days, it was doing that, but it's identified.
so you'd undone all of the mistakes that Glenn Gilmore had done. Well done, Marty.
One of my favorite mistakes, and it's so easy. If you haven't dealt with a lot of breakers, you'll think this is crazy. But whenever we put like young guys on horses, it's amazing how quick they can get them stuck to a fence. Like, the horse will just suck up to the fence, because what happens is the horse doesn't really understand, and it goes to the fence, and all of a sudden they can't kick with the outside leg. So the horse ends up, well, that's somewhere I want to go, because like, the pressure comes off. Before you know it, they are. You got to peel them off the fence.
Some horses just love running your leg into the fence.
Well, that's just an earlier stage of being stuck to the fence.
Yeah. And the simple way to fix that or to not allow it to happen, which once again is experience, if you've got a horse trotting around clockwise and it's the second you feel it, you're trying to turn it right off the fence, the second you feel it fading to the fence, turn it left. Turn it into the fence. That's where it wants to go. take it there. And I guarantee you, you turn it that way a couple of times and it's like, oh, shit, that fence is not fun.
That's harder work.
Because the harder you pull on that right rein, all you're doing is bending its head to the right. Its left shoulder, left side is open, and it's just like, oh. And you're making it easier for the horse. You're better off not touching the reins if you don't know how to turn it into the left, and it won't happen.
This is fantastic, Marty. And I've got a lot more questions, and I want to go into this process more. But I'm also conscious of the fact that we've got a bloke who is literally almost face down on his laptop, having, you know, he's suffered a business class all the way from Singapore. You know, he's been on the Zimfan.
I was in economy from Munich. Thank you.
Yeah, well, of course you were. That first class hospitality is now sort of kicking in, and he's fading fast. And Glenn's obviously the hangover is just kicking in. So we've got two subpar presenters, and I want to make sure that we're on top form. So
it's been awesome, mate.
What I'd like to do is, if it's all right with you, Marty, is if we do a pause on this one and then we try and reschedule another session with you.
Because we're about halfway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we've still got a lot to go. Still got a lot of questions that I want to ask you. Brilliant. Is that all right with you, Ross?
Yep, that's good. Thank you very much. My eyes look like piss holes in the snow. Look at them.
Yeah, I'll edit that out. Thanks very much. Cheers.
No, thank you, Jet. It's been good. So it'd be good to continue on. We're about halfway, so there's a lot more to go.
Yeah, exactly. There's loads to go, and I don't want to. And also for the listeners, I don't want this to end up in a marathon as well. So I'd love to come back and pick up with definitely. You. That's all right, Marty. Awesome. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Marty. Appreciate it. Are you coming to England this year?
Yeah, I'll be there at some point.
Cool. Look,
when I finish the breakers, I'll get there.
Nick, right, Nick, cool. what have you got to say, Nick?
Shut up. I preferred it when you were semi-comatose. I preferred it when you were falling asleep. You were much more used to me then. And Glenn, you can go and get a couple more hours sleep. Bless him. Marty, thanks very much. Roscoe, I hope your next shit's a hedgehog. Glenn, go and get some sleep.
See you, Marty. See you, Roscoe. Bye. Cheers. Nicholas.
Cheers. Bye. We hope you enjoyed the episode. We'd love to hear from you, to get your feedback and find out how we can improve. Feel free to reach out to us on Instagram or email us at podcastnrg@gmail.com or reach out to us on Facebook. Don't forget, we've also got a YouTube channel now, and we'll be putting more stuff up on that. Lastly, if you go to iTunes and write us a review, that really helps the podcast get noticed and get the message out there. Once again, thank you so much for listening. We love doing this podcast. We love getting your feedback. So please keep it coming. Thank you so much. See you next time.